You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice. That's a little loud. Believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and it's Friday. So, of course, it's time for our national town hall meeting with a guy I think of as America's senator, although the fine people of Vermont are very proud to call him their senator, Senator Bernie Sanders. And his website, sanders.senate.gov. Hey, Bernie.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm fine, although the people of Colorado are not so well. It's a really sad, sad day.
No, that is just a horrendous tragedy, and we send out condolences and best feelings to the people of that state.
Yeah. Now, in the meantime, you've got taxes, jobs, the deficit. There's a lot that's supposed to be going on in the Senate.
I'm calling you from Rutland, Vermont, and I wanted to thank the Southwestern Vermont Council on Aging for allowing me to crash their office. But I'm in Rutland because we just opened what is called a CBOC, which is a community-based outreach clinic for the Veterans Administration. We have five of them in the state. And I just wanted to mention to any veteran out there that what a CBOC is a primary health clinic located in areas, communities all over the country. And people might want to check it out because it means you can get your primary health care through the VA without having to travel perhaps a long distance to the major medical center near you. So if there are any veterans out there who are in need of health care, check out the VA and check out your neighborhood CBOC.
Okay.
There was a lot that went on this week. Just yesterday, there was a vote, and unfortunately, we lost it again through a Republican filibuster. We ended up with 56 votes, and this one dealt with outsourcing. Tom, as you and I have discussed for many years now, one of the reasons that the middle class is disappearing is that we have lost millions of good-paying manufacturing jobs. Not all of them, but many of them can be attributable to a disastrous trade policy. That's NAFTA, permanent normal trade relations with China, and so forth. What the Democratic leadership brought up yesterday, which got, I think, all of the Democrats plus three Republicans, was a small part of that issue. But what it said is that right now, if you are an American company and you say, hey, I want to move to China, I want to move to some low-wage country where I could pay people 50 cents an hour, you get a tax deduction for your moving expenses. So if you're dismantling a manufacturing facility, it takes a lot of money. You got to shut it down. You got to move your machinery abroad, perhaps. And you can deduct that as a business expense. So shutting down in America and moving abroad, you can get a tax deduction for that. So obviously that did not make a lot of sense to many of us, and that a bill came up yesterday to eliminate that tax deduction. And in fact, they go a little bit further and say, if you are a company abroad and you want to move back into the United States of America, we'll give you a tax credit. So this was an effort to make it a little bit harder for companies to shut down, a little bit easier for companies to move back. We got all of three Republican votes. We did not get the 60 votes that we needed to overcome just another filibuster. I mean, there was a time not so many years ago where it took 51 votes to win on major issues. Now, under the Republican obstructionist approach, it takes 60 votes on any significant issue. So we didn't get the 60
votes.
This
is not how the founders and the authors of the Constitution envisioned it.
Absolutely. And the other vote that took place earlier in the week, and we've talked about this issue as well, was the Disclose Act. I think and hope that all of our listeners know how horrendous this 5-4 Supreme Court decision on Citizens United was passed a couple of years ago. And what that decision has done is open the floodgates for large corporations and billionaires to start spending as much money as they want on campaigns without disclosure, without any disclosure. So what this bill was a very, very conservative bill to my mind, a very simple bill. And what it said is that if you're going to be spending more than $10,000 on political campaigns, when you make that expenditure, you have to announce, you have to put on the website who you are, how much you're spending. I don't think that's a terribly onerous requirement.
Right.
But the Republicans filibustered that. And I find that ironic because Republicans like Mitch McConnell, who have long been opposed to campaign finance reform, putting real restrictions on the amount of money that, that wealthy people can spend in an election, their argument has always been is you don't need campaign finance reform. You don't need to limit the amount of money. What you really need is disclosure, sunshine, disinfectant. That's been their mantra for years. But now we gave them the opportunity to vote for that, and we didn't get. I don't believe we got one Republican vote. So what I think is going on there is Republicans understand that with the Koch brothers prepared to spend $400 million, Sheldon Adelson prepared to spend at least $100 million, and other big money interests prepared to buy elections, they're doing just fine. They don't want to rock the boat on this. So we did not get one vote on what was a very, I think, conservative approach. Obviously, we've got to go a lot further. In my view, we need to have a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. And I've got an amendment in. And I believe, by the way, next week, if my recollection is right, there's going to be a hearing on this. Dick Durbin's subcommittee is going to hold a hearing on the need for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. So we should pay attention to that. And I'll be testifying on that during that hearing. The other thing this week that was important is, you know, we're hearing a lot of discussion about the so-called cliff, fiscal cliff that is that is approaching and sequestration and so forth.
Taxmageddon and all this stuff.
Pardon me?
Taxmageddon is how they're describing it.
I was on the floor talking about that, and I just want to summarize what I said on the floor. And here's the point. We have close to a $16 trillion national debt. $1.2 trillion deficit, that's a serious problem. But as we approach deficit reduction, we can never forget, we should never forget how we got to where we are. And to remember that when Clinton left office and in 2000 and Bush took office in January 2001, this country was running a $230 billion surplus. And we were on our way to eliminating the debt that we had at that point. We had a significant surplus. And the question that we have got to ask is how we went from a surplus at the end of Clinton's administration to huge deficits under Bush. And the answer is not very complicated. If you go to war in Afghanistan and Iraq and you don't pay for those wars, you run up a very large deficit. If at the same time as you're spending huge sums of money on two wars that you're not paying for, you then give huge tax breaks, much of it to the wealthiest people in this country, you're going to run up a large deficit. And last but not least, if as a result of the illegal behavior and the greed and the recklessness on Wall Street, your country is plunged into a terrible recession, revenue, the amount of money the federal government receives in comparison to its our GDP is going to be the lowest that it has been in 60 years. So right now we're getting about 15.2% of our GDP in revenue, which is extremely low. So you add those factors together, you're going to run up a very, very large deficit and add to our national debt. Now, what my Republican friends are saying is that, be that as it may, their solution toward moving toward deficit reduction is to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, and other important programs. I think that that is absolutely wrong, and we can talk about that later in terms of where we might want to go for deficit reduction.
Okay, we'll pick that up on the other side of the conversation. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Up next, your calls for Bernie.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And check out Senator Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov, and also at tomhartman.com. You can drop into our live chat room, make your own blogs, all kinds of cool stuff. It's all free.
The first duty of government is to protect the economic welfare of all the people in all sections and in all groups. I said in my message opening the last session of the Congress that if private enterprise did not provide jobs this spring, government would take up the slack.
There you go. Wow. From the man himself, FDR. Welcome back. Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. And Bernie, ready to pick up some calls here.
Well, let me just pick up on Roosevelt's point.
Sure.
Right now you have something like 24 million people in this country who are unemployed or underemployed. And I think what Roosevelt said back in the 30s is relevant today. We need a massive jobs program. We need to rebuild our infrastructure, transform our energy system, change our trade policies so that companies start reinvesting in America. So I think what Roosevelt said back in the 30s rings true in 2012.
Yeah, and it worked so well, he got elected four times as President of the United States. It's a testimonial to it, I think. LaDon in Evan Park, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Senator Sanders. Last week when you finished, you asked, you said you need to get more progressives in elected. I want to know how you do that, and could you tell me, do you support Jill Stein of the Green Party for president?
No, I don't. And I'll tell you why. I have, and I think people on this show have heard me expressing a lot of criticism at the president, because I don't think he has been tough enough on Wall Street. I don't think he has been as vigorous as he should be taking on Republicans. I don't think he has fought as hard as he could for the kinds of jobs programs that we need. But, LaDon, what I would say is that at this point, to see a Mitt Romney get elected president, to see Republicans gain control over the Senate and the House would be an unmitigated, unprecedented disaster for working families in this country. I am not a Democrat and I'm not a Republican, and I have run on third parties as well. So I respect third party advocacy. I think third parties play today and have historically played a really important role in raising issues and pushing other candidates in the proper direction. But in this election, I will be supporting, doing my best to see that Obama gets reelected.
And her thought about how do we support progressive candidates?
I think we need
movements.
What we need is for politicians to understand that the American people are watching, that they know what they do, and that they are prepared to support those people who have a progressive agenda. They're prepared to support those elected officials who have the guts to take on big money interests, because especially with Citizens United, that is not easy. You can beat the advocates for big money if you have a strong grassroots movement. And what we need to do is develop that movement. We need a progressive agenda, which among other things says no cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Wealthy have got to start paying their fair share of taxes. We've got to end these corporate loopholes. We need to transform our energy system. We need a new trade policy. We need a massive jobs program, rebuilding our infrastructure. I mean, those are just some. We need to protect women's rights. We need to deal with, address the crisis of global warming. I mean, those are just some of the issues that are out there. We need to have our elected officials, our candidates, speak into those issues, support them when they're for a progressive agenda, oppose them when they're not. And that's kind of where I think we have to go.
Stacy in Seattle, listening on Talk 1090, where I'll be doing a gig tomorrow. Actually, I'll be in Seattle tomorrow for this. Anyhow, Stacy, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Sanders. I just have great respect for both of you, and I wish we could clone Bernie. You know, we'd be in a better place. My question is about voter suppression, and is anybody doing about it, and what can we as the people do about it? Because to me, that's the most un-American thing you can do.
Stacey, I really could not agree with you more, and you use the right term. Look, when you're in politics, you don't win all of the time. I've run, I've lost, I've run, I've won. But if you have any belief in what you stand for, you go out to the people and you make your case. What you don't do is make it harder for certain groups of people to participate in the political process. That means you're afraid. That means you don't have the guts to stand on what you believe. And that the only way you think you can win elections is to deny people access to the ballot box. So what we're seeing right now are two pushes. which, in my view, are disastrous for democracy and for working families in general. Number one, of course, is Citizens United, which says to billionaires, hey, you can own the political process. You want to buy the United States government? Here it is. Contribute hundreds of millions of dollars to elect candidates to protect the wealthy and the powerful. And the other part of it, which is equally nefarious, is the effort on the part of a number of Republican governors and legislatures to make it harder for low-income and working people to participate in the political process. And that's what we call voter suppression. And that is under the guise of fighting voter fraud. They're coming up with requirements which make it very difficult for people to vote, in some cases, through the need for a photo ID. And if you don't have a car, you may not have that driver's license. You may have to travel long distances. You may have to pay money to get it. But the effort is very clear. The effort is a very coordinated approach to make it harder for low-income people, for senior citizens, to be able to vote. And as Stacey just said, if there's anything that's un-American, man, that is it. To make it hard, we want to see more and more people participate in the political process. And if I can't convince, as an elected official, as a candidate, if I can't convince those people to vote for me, then I'll lose. That's called democracy. But you don't go around making it hard for people to participate in the political process.
It's our Brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls in our national town hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman program. Check out Senator Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov, and, of course, ours at tomhartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 866-987-THOM.
More with your calls for Bernie right after this opportunity to catch the news and support your local station. Friday, so it's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Sanders here for our national town hall meeting, sanders.senate.gov, his website, and picking up your calls. Bernie, you're still with us, right?
I'm right here.
Okay. Liz in Glen Valley, California, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, Senator Sanders, I am so happy to be able to speak to you directly. I was a court clerk here in California for the Superior Court for over 30 years. I worked for some wonderful judges, some brilliant, brilliant men, some, you know, average guys and some not so smart guys, but I have never seen behavior exhibited like I have by the Supreme Court, by Scalia and Thomas. And their behavior is absolutely despicable. Most judges would have recused themselves from any matter where they had personal friendships or personal interactions or their wives had interactions. And what these two men have done to this country have so totally brought down the whole court system. I think they both need to be impeached. And I was hoping that you would put forth an amendment to do the same.
Well, I'm not prepared to bring forth an amendment, Liz, and thank you so much for your kind words. But I do agree with you. And I think it's the American people agree with you that I think there is a perception now, and probably primarily because of Thomas and Scalia, that the court has been just heavily politicized, and that you have a 5-4 Republican majority, although that did not play out for maybe other reasons in the healthcare decision, and their willingness to associate with extreme right-wing organizations and be just as upfront, you know, just as political as they want, I think denigrates the respect that the American people have for the Supreme Court. The theory, at least, is that when you're a judge, and certainly if you're a member of the Supreme Court, you're supposed to push politics aside, and you're supposed to weigh the issues on their legal merits. And I would agree with you very much that I think the Supreme Court and maybe the entire judiciary has been tarnished because of the politicalization of the court led by these two guys.
Pat in Orfordville, Wisconsin, if I'm saying that right. Pat, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Darn good.
Thank you.
And, Senator, I'd marry you in a moment, but I know you're already married.
I'm happily married. Thank you, Pat.
I know. I just wanted to tell you about an experience that I've done a couple of times, and last night was one of them. I went to a Tea Party meeting.
Good.
I need to know what they're thinking
Good.
In order to
Good
combat
for you.
Them. And mm-hmm. so there were about 40 people there. 80%, 85% were over 60. Mm-hmm. And they were like sheep. They listened to the speaker. There was a person called Chad Kent who spoke on the Commerce Clause because he's some kind of an expert on the Constitution. And it's like I couldn't get him pinned down as to how he knew except that he studied it. And he was just feeding them things, and they digested it and didn't understand it, but they were willing to accept it. And then they showed a film by Bill Whitnall. Now, Tom, maybe you know either of these people.
I don't.
Well, this Whitnall is just throwing such horrible vitriol out, and it was just shocking. You might want to look him up. Evidently, he's online, and you can watch, get his videos. Mm-hmm. And they just expounded about how wonderful he was. And when I addressed that, how can you vote for Romney when Romneycare and Obamacare are basically the same? People kind of shook their heads, but they said, well, we don't like Mr. Romney, but we got to get rid of Obama. I mean, there was just this crazy
Well, Pat, let me say this to you, first of all. Congratulations for doing what I think too few people do, is that you walked into a room where people have disagreements with you and you're prepared to dialogue with them. And I think that is very, very important, a very positive thing to do. My experience, I think when you look at the Republican Party right now, the real movers and shakers, of course, are the people with the money. And I find it, and I can understand that. Obviously, you know, if you are a Mitt Romney, or if you're a Mr. Koch, or if you're a you know millionaire or a billionaire, and you really don't care about the United States terribly much, and all you worry about is getting tax breaks to make it easier for you to pollute the environment or make it easier for you to ship jobs abroad, I can understand you supporting Mitt Romney. But what I cannot understand, and what we have got to fight very, very hard, and what Pat has done, is you find that within the Tea Party, you've got a lot of working-class people. And we have to speak with those people. We've got to dialogue with them and say, why are you knocking your brains out to make sure that billionaires get more tax breaks? Why are you knocking your brains out to make sure that these guys cut social your Social Security and your Medicare and ship your job to China? Now, I think the problem here is, frankly, that the Democrats have not been as strong as they should be in providing an alternative agenda to many of these folks. And I think if the Democrats were stronger in defending Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, were stronger in fighting for a trade policy which protected American workers rather than the CEOs of large corporations, were stronger in creating the jobs that this country desperately need, I think a lot of those people would see a difference. The right wing, the Karl Roves of the world have done a very, very good job in bringing up wedge issues, creating incredible animosity, creating a parallel universe, if you like, with regard to Obama. He's not born in America. He's not a Christian. He's not this. He's not that. And that's what they are doing. But I want to really sincerely congratulate Pat for dialoguing with people in the Tea Party, because I think there are people there who are angry and may not know exactly why they're angry. And they're angry because their standard of living is declining. They're angry because their kids are going to have less of an income than they have. And we have got to direct them to the causes of those problems and try to deal with these, get them away from some of these wedge issues, which are just not productive for anybody, I think.
Charles in New York, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders, I have followed you a lot on Hardball and all the other shows with Ed Schultz and them. And I just want to ask you maybe a two-part question. With Obamacare giving these businesses a right to come home with taxation, is it not in our best interest as a country to have another an industrial revolution going on with the minimum wage as it is now to bring these these companies home, like GE and these other companies that have participated in diminishing our country and trying to turn us into a third world country. And the other part of my question is that the Affordable Health Care Act, I believe, is to help females. When Obama passed the right for females to have the same wage as a man, when we all get older, these boomers, and I'm a boomer also, that these kids, my kids, your grandkids, will not have the wealth to go for all these health care issues, because we're going to be participating in a country where there's going to be a huge amount of elderly. And so I believe that the Affordable Health Care Act is good.
Well, this is what I'm not quite sure what the question is, Charles, but let me just tell you what I think. I think that one of the reasons that our economy is in as bad a shape as it is in terms of unemployment and declining wages has a lot to do with the deindustrialization of America, the loss of good-paying manufacturing jobs. And that is why I have vigorously opposed all of these trade agreements, NAFTA, CAFTA, permanent normal trade relations with China, because I just saw this as an opportunity for corporate America to throw our workers out on the street and move abroad and bring their products back in. I do believe, I think maybe the point that Charles was making, and we should pay more attention to, is that while we try to bring companies back into this country, we want to make sure that in manufacturing, they're paying them a decent wage. Because for blue-collar workers, the gold bar has always been a unionized manufacturing job. You can make good wages. But what unfortunately is happening now is you're seeing a decline in wages in many manufacturing sectors. You're having some blue-collar workers, manufacturing workers, making $12-13 an hour. And if those folks are making $12 or $13 an hour, think what the people in the service industry are making. So if Charles's point is that we have to make sure that manufacturing jobs continue as they have historically to pay good wages, in that regard, he is absolutely right. In terms of healthcare, yes, we are an aging nation. What we did do in, and again, let me repeat, I voted for the Affordable Care Act. I think it's a step forward. I don't think it goes as far as it might. And as I think many listeners know, here in Vermont, we are trying to lead the nation into a Medicare for All single-payer system, which I think is really the only way you're going to be able to provide a cost-effective quality care to every man, woman, and child. But one of the things that we did do, Charles, in the Affordable Care Act, and I work with Senator Harkin of Iowa on this, is we put a lot of money into disease prevention, figuring out ways that we can keep people healthy, which is a lot better approach than having to treat them in the hospital.
Which is much more expensive. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. We'll be right back with more of your calls for Bernie. Right,
you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And when you get a chance, check out Sanders.Senate.gov as well. Back with more with Senator Sanders and your questions right after this. Helping you win the water cooler wars, it's the Tom Hartman Program, our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. James in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. Hey,
Hi,
during the Bush administration, and when they had control of the Senate and the House, they got almost everything they wanted passed by one vote through the House and through the Senate. Now, how did the filibuster become to be what it is all of a sudden when the Democrats took control of the Senate? This is what kind of baffles me.
James, you're asking a very good question. What Bush was able to do, without going into all of the arcane, and they are very arcane, rules of the Senate, there is a process by which you can get a bill on the floor and get 51 votes. It's called budget reconciliation. and it's technical, and you got to go through the parliamentarian's office and so forth and so on. And if you're asking me, have the Democrats been as aggressive as they should be in trying to use that approach as one way to combat a Republican obstructionism, I would agree with you, they have not.
Okay. Let's see here. Excuse me. Michael in Cambridge, Mass., watching us on Free Speech TV. Michael, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, nice to hear you on the television show. I was wondering if there was anything you might be able to do in the Senate regarding abandoned property both in federal and in the state treasurer's offices. There's a lot of money, and it's building up, and it seems to me that if they were to hire a few more people to help find and locate the people whose money it is, it might get it back in the economy and help the economy that way.
My guess is, Michael, that is more of an issue that the states would deal with. I know in Vermont, every year I think they have full-page ads telling people money that they are owed, that they haven't collected, and there's an effort to try to reach out to those people. But I think, in general, I think that's handled more at the state level.
Ray in Astoria, Oregon. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I'm so happy to speak to you. We know what the WTO has done to a lot of our laws, you know, no more dolphin-safe tuna and stuff. And I was wondering if you could comment on the Trans-Pacific partnership thing that's brewing right now.
Yep. I have talked to our trade representative just on that issue, Mr. Kirk. And we'll be meeting with some of his staffers, I think, fairly soon. Because I have, as I have in the past, I have strong concerns about this particular trade agreement. What Ray is talking about is some of these trade agreements make it impossible for state government or the federal government to do appropriate things to protect the American people, whether it's environmental or labor, because of an international agreement which has precedence over federal or state law. And I share Ray's concern about that. I also worry that in the Trans-Pacific agreement being negotiated, that my understanding is that a lot of the big corporations and the drug companies are involved in writing the agreement, and yet it's very hard for even members of Congress and the general public to know what's going on. I have been interested specifically in the prescription drug issue and have been concerned that often poor countries are being forced to pay much, much more for drugs because the pharmaceutical industry has put language into these agreements which make it harder for them to get the generic equivalent of the brand name. So that's one issue that we are looking at. But by and large, my concern about trade agreements has been that they are often written by and for the multinational corporations and are not there to protect the needs of American workers.
Stephen in Gainesville, Florida, listening on 88.5 FM in Tampa. Hey, Stephen, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
My wife wouldn't like it, but I'd marry you in a heartbeat, too.
Geez, Bernie, one presidential bid and two marriage proposals in one day.
I called it. Well, first, before I get to my question, I want to remind people about your book, The Speech, and that all the proceeds from that go to a charity, so they might want to read that book. It's an amazing book about tax policy.
But well, see, thanks very much for the plug. And the speech was basically the speech that I gave on the floor of the Senate in December of 2010. It was an 8.5-hour speech, and basically it's the transcription of that speech. And what I try to do in that one, and I'll give the mic back to Steve here in a second, is just to lay out what I thought was some of the major economic issues facing this country and provide some alternatives. But thanks, and we did. We provided the funds, the profits from that, the royalties from that go to the Parent-Child Center in Addison County, Vermont.
Yeah,
Steve,
I commend you for it.
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, you're fine. I commend you for the book. I wanted to talk to you about what I call the campaign industrial complex, which Citizens United created. And I have two problems, simple issues with it. One, I think that one of the problems is that we're relying on the media who actually benefit from Citizens United to kind of inform us about how crooked this is. And I also wanted to get you to comment on, you know, we keep hearing from one party or the other about how the upper class need, and I call them upper class rather than higher income, need higher tax breaks, and that's gonna what's gonna fix the economy. But at this end, and that's what's gonna help.
Stephen, I'm gonna have to cut. Just throw this to Bernie because we just have 40 seconds left. I'm sorry.
Okay, Tom. Steve raises two very good questions. He is absolutely right. In terms of Citizens United, television stations and networks all over America are receiving huge amounts of money from these independent political organizations. So they are benefiting very, very handsomely from Citizens United, and they are in a real conflict of interest, if you like. Citizens United is working just great for them. I'm sorry, then the second question, Tom, was?
I think it was about getting money out of politics.
Well, Steve is right on that one as well. Ultimately, Steve, we have to not just defeat Citizens United, we have to move, in my view, to public funding of elections.
Bernie, thanks so much for being with us this week.
Okay, good to be with you, Tom.
Great talking to you. We'll see you next week. Thanks, Friday. It's check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. Up next, Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. This is fascinating. Zach Bocamp posting over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress. One of the principal weapons used by the shooter, I'm reluctant to even put his name out there. You know, these people, his name and face are all over. It's what they want. Right? I would not put his face if I owned a website that did news, and I'm not going to be using his name, frankly. But anyhow, one of the principal weapons used by this guy in the horrific Dark Knight shooting was the AR-15 rifle. It would have been illegal if the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994, which was passed using reconciliation, so it expired at the end of 10 years, if it had been renewed. In other words, the assault weapons ban. Also, the clip he had in it would have been a violation of the law. So it's pretty amazing stuff. In the meantime, Brother Jeff. Jeff Fard is with us, a.k.a. Brother Jeff, writer, historian, and community organizer, anti-gun activist. BrotherJeff.com is website. Brother Jeff, welcome to the program.
Tom, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us about yourself and the work that you're doing there in the Denver area.
Well, around 95, I created a cultural center. It's called Brother Jeff's Cultural Center, and it's in Northeast Denver Five Points. And it was in direct response to a lot of gangs, drugs, and violence that was happening in the community. And we had saw a lot of gun violence, a lot of youth violence. And we created an organization and an institution to address that through education, early childhood education, employment, and et cetera. So we've been involved with this issue of gun violence for quite some time.
What are your thoughts on what happened last night?
Well, you know, I also have a community newspaper. It's called the Five Points News. And the tragedy is that Colorado and in this area has been going through a lot recently. We've just gone through the killing of a police officer at a jazz festival. And then I woke up at around 5 this morning to hear that, you know, individuals that just showed up to the movie theater anticipating a show were faced with a massacre. So I was in disbelief, and it's kind of like the wind, the sails come out from beneath you, and then you just start hearing from everyone calling, and they're seeing if their loved ones are all right. And, you know, our state right now is in a state of disbelief, and I just cannot say enough to the families in terms of condolences, and, you know, a lot of prayers are going out right now, Tom.
Jeff Fard, Brother Jeff, do you have any sense about whether this finally, I mean, Columbine happened in Colorado, now this. Colorado is a state that historically has not been, or at least the majority of Coloradans, have not been fans of things like the assault weapon ban. Do you think that there might be some state legislation comes out of this?
Well, I think, you know, there's something about our structure that seems to bring this stuff to the forefront and make us take a good, hard look at it. Columbine is a perfect example. It put youth violence and guns at the forefront, took it to the congressional level. And let me tell you, Tom, I woke up at, like I said, 5 a.m. I had the place where the theater was only about 10 minutes away from my home. So I went over there to see what was going on and saw all of the police and everything being blocked off. But I also went over to the Gateway High School, which was the staging area for those people who were looking for loved ones, because it was just total chaos, people trying to find missing loved ones. And, you know, I can only imagine the despair that was happening in the theater, because if you could listen to the sounds that were coming out of the school, the horror, the trauma, you know, the tears, the shouting, the total despair, it was a scene that I don't even think that the movie that they were going to see could have rivaled.
Yeah, yeah. So do you think that there will be, what is there an appropriate legal response to this?
Well, you know, right now our city and our state is going through that process. It's kind of like disbelief, and then they're going to move into what needs to happen next. I believe that there is going to be a larger national discussion. As you know, the president will be coming back to town. People are going to be wrestling with, why did this happen? And they're going to look at the profile of this the one that was arrested, and they're going to say, well, you know what? Educated, PhD seeking individual, could have been any one of us. And so now we can't just limit it to some crazed fringe group. We have to take a deeper look at what's happening around guns, these laws, this access. They're going to start talking about where he got the guns, were they legal, where he got the bulletproof vest, all of this stuff that is so readily accessible. People are going to say, wow, why is this so readily accessible, and what's the need for bulletproof vests? What's the need for, you know, assault weapons, et cetera? And I believe it's going to bring this discussion right to the forefront once again, and it's going to be handled eventually, or it's going to continue to happen.
Yeah, well, I can tell you where he got the guns. He bought them at the Bass Pro Shop and Gander Mountain Guns legally. Wow. And one of them, the AR-15, apparently had a high-capacity clip, which would have been banned by the 1994 legislation, which expired in 2004, was not renewed by the Bush administration. This, to me, I would think that if nothing else, this is an opportunity for people to say, okay, enough already. You know, we get it that people want to have a handgun to protect themselves, you know, in their home or to carry in their purse or on in their car or something like that. But who needs an AR-15 with a 25 clip, a round clip?
And that's the tragedy. That's what we want to bring to the forefront and say, you know what, of course, protect yourself. But if you could listen to the commentary that's happening, and everyone's response or many responses are, I'm going to get my concealed carry permit. I'm going to rearm myself. I'm going to get more and bigger guns. I'm going to make sure that I'm safe when I go, you know, to the gas station. I'm going to make sure that I'm safe when I go to the movie theater. I don't know if more and more guns is the response. I think we need to look at a deeper systemic approach to why is this type of behavior seeming to continue to bring itself to the forefront.
And, you know, there's an enormous amount of evidence that unequal societies, societies where the rich are richer and the poor are poorer and the middle class gets smaller, which the United States, Singapore, and the UK are the most unequal societies on Earth right now, or at least among the major developed countries, have much higher rates of this kind, this exact kind of thing. We have 20 mass murders a year on average in the United States. And countries that are more equal, that, you know, Canada, Holland, you know, Finland. I mean, even there was a horrible one in Norway, but it's like the only one in like 50 years. I mean, they're very, very rare in countries that have less equality. Do you see other societal factors in addition to that that we should be addressing? Jeff?
Well, you know what? I mean, it would have been easier for me to kind of wrap my mind around it if it was the common so-called urban, you know, was this stereotypical missing man in the house and all of these different things. But when you talk about these type of situations that everybody's coming in with a gas mask and, you know, firing and throwing out smoke bombs and doing all of the things that you would see in some kind of an action movie or something that is so far beyond what anybody can imagine, I don't even know how to wrap my mind around this.
Yeah, this is essentially a military assault. And I find it incredible. The guys on the right, they're all going, well, this just proves everybody, if everybody in the theater had a gun, everything would have been fine. Yeah, bullets flying all over the place. But not only would they have to have a gun, they would have had to have a gas mask because the guy threw these tear gas canisters in and waited for them to explode before he started shooting. And so nobody could even see what was going on. Maybe he did that thinking that somebody in the theater had a gun. And so bottom line is not, you know, if you want to extend that NRA logic, everybody, you know, from now on, when you go out, don't just pack your gun, wear a gas mask, carry your night vision goggles, and wear a flak jacket. That's the new America. This is insane. Brother Jeff, thanks for being with us. BrotherJeff.com, the website. I appreciate you dropping by.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, sir. We will be back with Anything Goes Friday. There's a lot going on. You know, if there was a trade agreement that involves Switzerland, Holland, and Argentina, you could call it the Shafta Agreement. Somebody ought to propose that. Right, NAFTA, CAFTA, Shafta.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But, you know, perhaps more importantly, how do we as a nation respond to this kind of crisis, frankly? It's a crisis. 20 of these a year, this is a crisis. Anything Goes Friday. Jerry in Long Island, listening to WWRL. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing? On that Massachusetts, on that Colorado mass shooting in the movie theater?
Yeah.
Well, I agree with you that, and I think in addition to us needing a restoring of the ban on assault weapons, on these military-style assault weapons, I also think that I would also point out that no right is considered absolute, not even the right of free speech. And so famously, you have that ruling by the nation's highest court about how you cannot falsely shout fire in a crowded theater, and yet we have the right to keep and bear arms so lionized and so regarded as absolute by so many people, thanks to the NRA, that our country's gun laws have become lax enough, both on a federal level and also on a state level, that any nut with a grudge could gain easy access to and bring a loaded gun into a crowded theater. And it's ironic because we don't have the right to bring our loaded mouth into a crowded theater and forcefully shout fire. And yet there's such easy access to the guns in this country that we have people bringing loaded guns into a crowded theater, loaded guns they should never have. And to me, this is a national problem that requires national solutions and political leadership and courage, even from the president, because I know that there's fears that if Obama goes in favor of any kind of gun control, such as the ones we're talking about, restoring the assault weapons ban, that the NRA is going to go after him. Well, they've been going after him anyway. As you pointed out on your show, you've received mail from the NRA attacking him and falsely accusing him of wanting to take guns away from people anyway. So if Democrats are going to be attacked anyway by the NRA, then I think they should go.
At least stand up to him. Yeah, no, I think that this we you know, we had the Brady Bill. I guess most of the Brady Bill is still intact, but the assault weapons ban. This guy was using an assault weapon, and it just becomes very, very clear to me. Jerry, thank you for your call. Catherine in Gig Harbor, Washington. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Hi, Tom. My question is this. Can the RNC, pursuant to its rules of nominating a presidential candidate, deny Romney the nomination and give it to somebody else for whom the Democrats will be completely unprepared?
Yes, they can. It's extremely unlikely. It would require a lot of delegates switching their votes. I'm pretty sure that they do have the right to do that, however, sort of like with the Electoral College. But I barring any sort of just massive meltdown, and the fact of the matter is that Romney's actually pulling ahead in the polls right now. So I don't think the Republicans are having buyer's remorse. They're attacking Obama. They're doubling down. Tens of millions of dollars have already been spent, maybe over $100 million. Hundreds of millions of dollars will be spent to tear apart the president's character, the president's record. To tear him apart in general, as well as every other Democrat in the country, and it is having an effect. It is starting to tear down his numbers. So I don't think that they're gonna change. I mean, theoretically they could, but I'm not holding my breath on that one. Thanks a lot for the call, Catherine. Brian in Plainfield, Illinois. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was wondering why no one is trying to repeal NAFTA or the World Trade Organization membership in the U.S.
Well, you know, Bernie, I don't know if he's sponsored legislation to repeal it. It probably wouldn't go any, it certainly wouldn't go anywhere. One of the big problems is that NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, all of these trade laws were supported by both the Republican and Democratic Party in you know, from 92 forward, when both Bill Clinton and George Herbert Walker Bush agreed on stage during the debates that Ross Perot was wrong and that they were right and that these trade agreements would be a good thing for our country. I think history demonstrates that they were both wrong and that Ross Perot was right. And
we've seen that they're definitely not good for the U.S. So why not revisit that and say we made a mistake, or even it's not what we thought it was and we need to do something different?
Well, the kind of encouraging news is that the Romney outsourcer meme, you know, somebody called in yesterday and said that he doesn't talk flowery to his conservative friends. He simply asked them two questions. Do you think Mitt Romney would fire you given a chance? And do you think that he would send your job overseas? You know, so, you know, as that storyline that the Democrats have been developing, that Mitt Romney is the guy who likes to fire people and that is enthusiastic about sending jobs overseas, it is forcing the Democratic Party to move in a more protectionist direction, which I think is a healthy thing. I've been saying this for all 9 years I've been doing this radio show. The day that one of these two political parties starts grabbing hold of protectionism, basically trade protectionism, and they're going to start winning elections like nobody's business. Bernie's been running on this for, you know, 18 years in the House and the Senate. He's never wavered on this stuff. And the people in Vermont love him for it. Sherrod Brown is taking these positions in Ohio, and I think it's one of the reasons he's as strong as he is there, although they're running all kinds of insane ads, you know, making up stuff about him and trying to tear him down and distorting his record. But they got the Koch brother money, and they got the Karl Rove money going into Ohio to try and take down Sherrod Brown. So I would say over the short term, in addition to, you know, waking everybody up, although more than 80% of people in national polls say, no, do away with the trade agreements, I'd say the thing to do is to get legislators who will speak about this. And the two that I know of who will speak on the record about this and speak loudly about it are Sherrod Brown, SherrodBrown.com, and Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org. And they're both running for reelection. And I would do everything I, you know, personally, if this was my issue, and do everything I could to make sure that they have a chance to get reelected, you know, that their message, in particular, their trade message gets out there.
Because thank you, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call. Because this is just like a core and seminal issue of our time. I don't know how to say it beyond that. Is, are we going to become, once again, a nation that makes things, a nation of makers? Or are we going to continue to be a nation that buys things from others and that is run by banksters? Banking used to be about 10% of our economy. It's now over 35% of our economy. Manufacturing used to be over 35% of our economy. It's now about 11% of our economy. That's wrong.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And it's not just like, you know, morally wrong. It's practically wrong. It doesn't work for a nation. Welcome back, my friends. Remember a couple of days ago, President Obama gave a speech, and in that speech, he said he made the grammatical mistake of either omitting a word or using a singular instead of a plural. All right, here's what he said. He said, it must be because I worked harder than everybody. He's talking about why are people successful in America. He says, and some people think, it must be because I worked harder than everybody else. Let me tell you something. There are a whole bunch of hardworking people out there. If you were successful, somebody along the line gave you some help. There was a great teacher somewhere in your life. Somebody helped to create this unbelievable American system that we have that allowed you to thrive. somebody invested in roads and bridges. If you've got a business, you didn't build that. Something else, somebody else made that happen. Now, what he's talking about is what he's saying is if you've got a business, you didn't build that infrastructure, or you didn't build those roads and bridges. So he should have said those, or he should have said he should have left in the word infrastructure. But, you know, for it to be untakeable out of context. But here's what I find amazing. Romney is about to release a campaign ad. The Romney campaign is about to release a campaign ad that literally lifts out that sentence about the bridges. You know, somebody invested in the roads and bridges. If you build a company, you didn't build that. You didn't build that infrastructure, right? So the Romney campaign ad now says, they've got Obama on tape and quoting Obama. But, you know, in saying this and quoting Obama, what this Romney ad is doing is it's omitting this sentence. And this is incredible. This is the piece that they're playing. If you've been successful, you didn't get there on your own. I'm always struck by people who think, well, it must be because I'm just so smart. There are a lot of smart people out there. It must just be because I worked harder than everybody else. Okay, that's all in context. And then they delete the part where he says somebody, you know, there was a great teacher in your life. Somebody helped you out. Somebody created this unbelievable American system that allowed you to thrive. Somebody invested in roads and bridges. They omit that. And so they go right from the new Romney ad. It goes right from, there are a lot of smart people out there. It must be because I worked harder than everybody else. Let me tell you something. If you've got a business, you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen. In other words, they're intentionally distorting the that that refers to roads and bridges. It's going to be really interesting to see if the American people buy this. I frankly think they will. I think that P.T. Barnum was right. Between his, there's a sucker born every minute, and actually it wasn't P.T. Barnum who said nobody ever failed to get rich betting on the ignorance of the American people or gullibility. It was a newspaper reporter, as I recall, or a newspaper man. His name is lost in the fogs of history because it was in the 19th century, but in any case, it concerns me. It concerns me that the Romney campaign would stoop to such a blatant lie, and that in all probability it'll work. Steve in River Forest, Illinois. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
Tom, I've been trying to think about what would be the best way to generate some excitement in this election cycle and push back against Citizens United. And the best conclusion that I can come to is that we need to push the Democratic caucus to take up a comprehensive voters' bill of rights as a party platform that would include a lot of different things like a national voting holiday, Bernie Sanders amendment, and maybe for the presidential election, instant runoff voting.
You know, I think an awful lot of that could be accomplished simply by adding an amendment to the Constitution that says voting is an absolute right of American citizens. Because once you establish that, then the job of government becomes to do anything it can to fulfill that right, to further that right. So, but Steve, I think that your point is well taken, and there have been suggestions for a Bill of Rights, a voter's Bill of Rights in the past. John in Philadelphia. Hey, John, what's up?
I just had a quick question about the, well, unfortunately, I've been listening to a lot of right-wing radio, and they keep saying about this penalty if your employer drops your insurance, they only have to pay this, and why would they keep insuring you if that fine's less? But is there a fine in place before that, you know, they had to make that logic, or is that just the straw man?
It's by and large a straw man. The fact of the matter is that if you're making under about, I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but you can find it over at healthcare.gov. I think it works out to somewhere in the neighborhood of $60,000 a year for a family of four. If you're making that or under that, then and say your employer drops your health insurance or you lose your job, you would qualify for tax credits and tax breaks that basically would make your purchase of health insurance free or damn close to free. And people making more than that, of course, would have to pay for it. Although it will be less expensive than it is right now. In addition to that, if you choose, let's say you're making more than $60,000 a year and you're in good health and you choose not to have any health insurance at all, then because you will then become part of that risk pool of Americans who show up in emergency rooms thinking that they're invincible until somebody broadsides their car, you know, some drunk driver at a red light or something. You become part of that pool of people who show up in the ER, and we all have to pay for them because of the ER mandate that Ronald Reagan pushed through in 86. Then you have to pay $695 a year, a one-time fee, as it were, to be part of that pool. And in Massachusetts, where this has been in place since, you know, geez, almost 10 years now, the risk pool, the number of people, the percentage of people who pay that $600 or $700 a year in order not to have to buy insurance is less than 1% of the population. So to whatever extent that's what the Supreme Court said is a tax, is that fine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a tax that fewer than 1% of Americans will pay, and those will be people who could easily afford to buy health insurance, because if you can't afford to get health insurance, you get it free. And
yeah.
You know, so it's basically it's kind of a tax on right-wing ideologues.
Okay. And just one more thing. Do you think the Obama campaign could rebut that Romney ad by just playing the rest of the statement in full context and just point out the Romney ad?
You know, I think they could if he had said those instead of that. You know, somebody built those roads and bridges. If you built a business, you didn't build those. You know, he was talking off the top of his head, and or if he had said that infrastructure, I know he was speaking shorthand. I do it on the radio all the time. We all do. But
we're all adults. We can understand it.
Yeah. But I think that by playing the clip that, even in context, you know, it's sort of like Mitt Romney said it the other day. You know, when you find yourself responding to the other person's attacks, you're losing. And so that's why the Romney campaign is going on the attack. And I don't think that Obama needs to respond to this. I think, you know, he needs his surrogates to respond to it. He needs to be getting, you know, members of Congress out there, people, you know, elected officials, people who can speak about it, speaking about that. But I don't think his campaign should. But, you know, then what do I know? I don't know. John, thanks for the call. Tina in Cottonwood, Arizona. Hey, Tina, what's up?
Hi. I'd like to know what you think of Obama's chances of winning in November. I think they're very good because I live in a conservative town. I have an Obama sticker on my car, and I get a lot of positive feedback wherever I go.
Well, that is great. I'm looking for Intrade here. Hang on just a second. I'll get the actual numbers.
Uh-huh.
Right now, it's 57.6% Obama, 39.6% Romney. Now, that's what the professional gamblers in the world are saying.
I say, don't worry, Obama will pull through.
Well, this is showing Obama winning by 57%.
Yeah, he will win.
57%.
Don't worry about it.
So, okay.
You know,
Tina, here's the biggest problem. If people don't worry about it, he won't win. We have to get people out there. We have to get people to show up. We have to get people active. But, you know, I'm with you that, I honestly don't know. I don't think you can predict the outcome of an election when the other side, the Romney campaign, we've had two leaks now out of the Romney campaign in the last 3 days, saying that in the final 3 weeks of this election, they are going to pull Reverend right out of the bag. They're going to pull out of the bag Obama's autobiography, in which he talks about being a kid and trying cocaine and marijuana. They're going to pull out of the bag the fact, you know, the pictures of him as a little kid, as a 6-year-old, you know, in Indonesia. They're going to pull all this stuff out of the bag and try and paint him as the other. And don't ever underestimate the power of racism in America and the power of just xenophobia. Sam in Stone Mountain, Georgia. Hey, Sam, what's up? We got a minute to the break. Quick one.
Yes. I would like to know that tape you played when Mr. Sanders was on about Roosevelt saying if Congress doesn't pass the bill for infrastructure, he will.
Right.
Now, why can't our president do that? Just run over the Republicans.
He can't, because when Roosevelt was elected, he had something like 67 or 68 votes in the Senate. He had a massive majority in the Senate and a massive majority in the House of Representatives. He could pretty much do whatever he wanted, and he did. Now, there were times when he had some obstruction from within his own party. He'd go out and he'd grumble like you heard, and things would get done very, very quickly. That's not the situation right now. They would have to, like I think, frankly, that they should have done yesterday, or the day before yesterday, with the Disclose Act, which got 56 votes in the Senate. So, according to the Constitution, it passed. But the Republicans said, no, we declare a filibuster. We're going to block it. I think Kerry Reid should have just blown up the filibuster. I don't think we should have had it in the first place. Sam, but that's just my thoughts. You know, Harry Reid doesn't agree with me, although I think he's maybe starting to think that way. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And given that it's Anything Goes Friday, let me just ask this question again. Any of my Republican listeners or viewers know why the Republicans turned the stars upside down?
Tuesday's great.
Friday. Happy Friday, and happy Friday, Victoria Jones, one of my favorite people. How are you doing today?
I'm very well, thanks, Tom. How are you?
Just great, but I'll get better. So what's going on? I shouldn't sound so chipper with this horrible news coming out of Colorado.
I understand. Well, it is horrible news coming out of Colorado, and of course I am leading with that. There are political dimensions to this, and you have been talking about part of those, of course. The gun aspect of this is a piece of this. Politicians reacting to it. President Obama was informed about this very early this morning, shortly after 5 o'clock Eastern, put out a statement almost within 90 minutes, and then decided that he would not campaign in Florida today, second day of a two-day swing through the state, and would instead return to Washington to monitor the situation. So he made a statement in Florida and then returned to Washington. Mitt Romney then followed suit, although he did actually have a campaign event, but included remarks in the campaign event about the shooting. They both spoke very movingly about the shooting and of both the campaign events, although the president's was not a campaign event. There were no signs, none of the bunting and all the usual things. They were both taken down. The president announced that he was not, he wished campaign ads to be taken down in Colorado. Then Mitt Romney said the same thing. And then Karl Rove, Crossroads GPS said the same thing. Editorial comment here. I find that interesting because it sort of says to me that they realize that there's something inherently funky about their campaign ads that they feel they must be taken down at this time.
Yeah, yeah.
Editorial comment over.
Yeah, well, I think it's a very, very pithy observation, an insightful observation.
Many politicians have reacted. Many have reacted appropriately, some more strongly than others. Mayor Bloomberg, I imagine you've had his reaction to this, basically saying that they need to do more, that Obama and Romney need to do more than just speak up. They need to actually do something right about gun control. Probably the strangest reaction to this comes from Representative Louie Gohmert, Republican of Texas. Today, speaking at the Heritage Foundation, tied the shooting to the ongoing attacks on Judeo-Christian beliefs, saying, you know, what really gets me as a Christian is to see the ongoing attacks on Judeo-Christian beliefs, and then some senseless, crazy act of a derelict takes place, he went on.
So he's trying to suggest that this guy is somehow, a militant atheist or Muslim or Hindu or something?
Well, I read as many of his remarks as I had available, which is quite a few, and I couldn't figure it out. But he did go on to say, people say you think there was a God. Where was God in all of this? He went on to say, we've threatened high school graduation participation. If they've used God's name, they're going to be jailed. So he went on about that. Where was God? What have we done with God? Then he said that the casualties could have been limited if somebody had brought a gun.
If somebody had brought a gun, right.
Yes.
But not just a gun, though. They would have had to have a gas mask as well.
Well,
so
this was interesting, because if everybody had had a gun, shooting in the smoke, they could have all shot each other because nobody could have seen anything.
Right. Well, but I see a great new franchise opportunity here for the National Rifle Association, because really, if anybody wanted to seriously take this guy on, they needed four things. He had a gas mask on, he had a flak jacket on, and he had a gun. Okay. So the NRA's got the guns.
Right.
But the thing that people would have had to have in the audience to successfully take him down is, in addition to a gun, which the NRA is already all over, they'd need to have a gas mask, they'd need to have a flak jacket, and they'd need to have night vision goggles. So I see it now as the national gun, national NRA, National Rifle Association. Okay, the National Rifle Gas Mask, Night Vision Goggles, and Flak Jacket Association.
NARUGFA.
Yeah, and they can bring in more manufacturers and get more money.
I think there's a tremendous franchising opportunity, sponsorship opportunity.
Indeed. Indeed. And then we all show up at movie theaters wearing our gas masks and our flak jackets and our night vision goggles.
It's a whole new look, in fact.
It could be. So,
indeed.
Back
to
you.
Thank you for that thought. I appreciate that. Representative Ed Markey went off today. There were three hearings in the House with different committees today on the issue of the Western wildfires, forestry, husbandry, and what to do about this. He went after Republicans for downplaying the role of climate change in recent wildfires. He basically said the Republicans will say that bureaucratic red tape and, quote, even immigrants are behind extreme weather incidents before they'll admit that climate change is the culprit. If we're serious about reducing catastrophic wildfires, we must first acknowledge there is a link between climate change and wildfires, he said. And then he used a baseball analogy to describe climate change, saying that people cannot pin one home run on steroids, but when there's 70 in one season, there is cause for concern.
Wow.
Yeah, he was quite ticked off about this.
Yeah, well said.
Also, the Pentagon's given service members the green light to wear their military uniforms at the Gay Pride Parade in San Diego, the first time that uniformed soldiers will be allowed to march in such a parade. The military actually bars active duty members from marching in uniform in most parades, but the DOD has made an exception for this year's San Diego event.
That is a BFD. That's a big deal.
It really is. They said, based on our knowledge of the event and existing policies, we hereby are granting approval for service members in uniform to participate in this year's parade. Now, they do say the exception is applicable only to this year's Gay Pride event.
Right. I think they're probably thinking, okay, we'll just kind of flush this out of the system, or, you know, make it so it's not, it won't be novel next year. It'll be novel and then it'll be over, kind of thing. I hope I don't sound too cynical. I who knows? Anyway.
Right. Exactly.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Have a nice weekend.
You too. You too. And we'll be back with more of your calls and thoughts and mine. A few things to riff on in the news in addition to the shooting in Colorado after this. It's Anything Goes Friday right here on the Tom Hartman Program, 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything Goes Friday today. As Mercury now is officially retrograde, has been all week. Anything that can go wrong will go wrong. Well, maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Jay in Scappoose, Oregon. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind?
Hey, Anything Goes Friday.
Indeed. So.
All right, let's go to 1908.
Okay. Hey, William Howard Taft.
William Howard Taft is running for president, and he's being introduced at a dinner by a minor politician named Chauncey Depew, who only won one election.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Depew decided to use some shock language on the portly Taft. And he to the audience, he said at the conclusion of his introduction, he said, "He's pregnant," which, if you know, in 1908 was not it was coarse language then.
Oh, really?
And, he would have said she's expecting her in the family way.
Uh-huh.
And he says, "He's pregnant." And the crowd gasps. He says, "With courage."
Ah.
"He's pregnant with hope. I give you our next president, William Howard Taft." And Taft walks up to the podium and he says, "Well, if indeed I am pregnant, and it turns out to be a boy, we'll name him Courage. And if it turns out to be a girl, we'll name her Hope. But if it is, as I suspect, merely guess, we'll name it Chauncey Depew."
That's great. And of course, William Howard Taft was, so shall we say, large of girth.
So, he was a big guy.
Yeah.
One of our largest presidents.
So you wonder.
But evidently, quick on his feet.
Yeah, yeah. Although they had to replace the White House bathtub because it didn't fit him. And
yes.
Yeah, a lot of interesting anecdotes about Taft. Jay.
Last question for you. Is Higgins going to run as an independent for president?
Higgins is getting to be an old cat. He hasn't attacked anybody. We've had a couple of people over doing work on the boat because that's what happens when you buy 30-year-old boats. And he's like, he hasn't attacked anybody in weeks. I think he's getting a little gray. So I don't think he's going to run for anything. I don't think he'd run for a mouse right now. He runs for dinner, but that's, what can you say? I still remember when he was a mere sprout and Louise and I, for the first 6 months we owned him, had to wear leather gloves to walk into the room. Literally, we had to wear leather gloves to walk into the room because he would attack us so ferociously. And now he just, he lays on the floor and the guy comes in to fix the plumbing and Higgins is like, too much work. So it happens. It happens. Jay, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Barry in Chicago. Hey, Barry, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I love your show. Everybody to listen to you all the time. You know, when you're talking about the different kinds of weapons and people shouldn't carry them, I thought, why don't we just carry spray or tasers or something that is a bullet that just knocks you out, like what they do with dogs. That way, you're not going to kill anybody.
Why don't we just carry a tax increase on rich people increase in the minimum wage that would decrease the income and wealth disparities in the United States so we'd become a more equal nation? And when you look at the statistics all around the world, the more unequal a nation is, the higher their homicide rate is. The more unequal a state is in the United States, the higher their homicide rate is. I mean, there's fundamental societal and cultural factors at work here that have to do in large part with inequality. So, Barry, I get it. I'm assuming that you're speaking facetiously.
I'm just saying that there's better ways to do this.
Yeah, than everybody. Well, I continue to think that, and thanks for the call, Barry, I continue to think this might be a wonderful opportunity for the National Rifle Association to rename themselves the National Rifle Flak Jacket, Night Goggles, and Gas Mask Association. And I've got to write that out and move the words around to come up with a good acronym for it. Maybe we can do something there. Micah in La Verne, California. Hey, Micah.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I have 2 points to make really quickly. I think you asked earlier about the President Obama's quote being taken out of context. And I've seen the practical results of that.
Okay.
Today I was at a barber shop.
Right.
And two gentlemen were discussing politics.
Right.
I thought, okay, here we go. And one of them mentioned that quote, and he said, did you see that Obama said nobody built it on their own and all that kind of stuff? And luckily the other gentleman and I both kind of looked at him and said, no, that's not what he said at all. But people really are buying it.
Yeah. Well, and beyond that, even if that was what he said, there's truth to that. Nobody builds a business on their own. It doesn't happen. I mean, you've got to use the court system. You got to use the roads. You've got to use people who have people working with you and for you who are educated. You've got to have consumers. But here's the actual, and thank you for sharing that story, Mike. I appreciate the call. Here's the actual clip of President Obama. In context, this is not what you will hear in the Mitt Romney ad. You will only hear the "you didn't to build that." But here's the whole thing right here.
If you've been successful, you didn't get there on your own. You didn't get there on your own. I'm always struck by people who think, well, it must be because I was just so smart. There are a lot of smart people out there. It must be because I worked harder than everybody else. Let me tell you something. There are a whole bunch of hardworking people out there. If you were successful, somebody along the line gave you some help. There was a great teacher somewhere in your life. Somebody helped to create this unbelievable American system that we have that allowed you to thrive. Somebody invested in roads and bridges. If you got a business, that you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen. The internet didn't get invented on its own. Government research created the internet so then all the companies could make money off the internet.
Yeah, it's basically everything happens on the substrate of everything that preceded it, and you can argue that everything, you know, in this country goes back to, well, arguably goes back to the Native Americans. I mean, you know, it's, but certainly in the modern context goes back to the founding of this country. Stacy in Seattle. Hey, Stacy, what's on your mind?
Yes, I was calling about that also. I was thinking, you know, Obama should take out an ad with the full contents of what he said.
Right.
You know, just to prove that Romney put that in there without the full contents, so it would make it seem like he's saying that one part.
Right.
But if he comes out with an ad showing, say, like, well, as you know, Romney's come out with an ad that says, I said this. I'm here to show you that the full content, so you know what I was talking about.
Yeah, I think the Democrats need to double down on this message. I really do. I don't. It, rather than saying, thank you, Stacey, for the call. Rather than saying Romney's taking it out of context, because what Romney's saying is Obama didn't say you can't build a business without infrastructure, which basically is what Obama said. What Romney's saying is if you build a business, you didn't build that. And I think that the Democrats should take that and run with it. And say, yes, if you built a business, you didn't do it yourself. There is nobody in America who built, who educated themselves, who never traveled on a road that wasn't public property, who didn't use the court system to create their corporation, who didn't use the police and fire to keep them safe, who didn't, you know, live in a community that operated by the rules of the community with city councils and schools and things. I mean, it's impossible. Nobody did it on their own in this country. And we need people to understand that. I mean, this is core 101. Most entrepreneurs, speaking as a serial entrepreneur, I haven't worked for another person other than you know, some work in radio I did in the late 60s, early 70s, since I was a teenager. I have always owned my own businesses. And I believe that I can speak for the vast majority of entrepreneurs I know. I used to be part of this Businessmen's Association in Atlanta for years and years. We would get together every month and just, you know, have a dinner together and drinks and whatnot. And people who had built their own companies. And you all get it. You get it. You don't do it on your own.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You so don't do it on your own that, you know, It's lonely at the top, as it were. You hang out with other people who've done it to talk about how you did it, or how we did it. For those of you watching television, there is Higgins taking on Guccellini in the back of our floating home about 5 years ago in Portland. Yes, back when Higgins was always ready for a fight with a goose. Yeah, there he is. We had this goose, Guccellini, whose mate was sitting on eggs on the dock of the house next to us. And, so he would not let me or any of us walk out the back door of our own house. And, Higgins just opened the screen, you know, opened the door and just leave the screen door there. And that goose and that cat, they would just sit there and hiss at each other for hours. It was just, you know, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. It was a hoot. Kathy in Etna, Wyoming. Hey, Kathy, what's on your mind today?
Tom, I'm scared to bring this up, but I just have to because I hear it so often. And while I enjoy your show and have the utmost respect for you and your program,
but
I have to say this. I resent it when I hear people say that they, the insured, pay for us, the uninsured, because we absolutely don't think we're invincible. But when we get sick, we have to go to ER. If we have to go to ER, we pay. We get a bill and we pay it. We always pay it. My husband had to have back surgery, and we went around and did bids where this doctor did his surgeries, and we got the best deal we could, and it worked, and we could afford it. But you know, insurance for a family of four is $1,200 to $1,600 a month, and that's as much as our mortgage payment. We can't do that.
Yeah. Okay.
Why is it that you guys or the insured say that they pay for us?
Well, because we do. But the
why?
Point,
how?
The cost, according to the insurance industry,
mm-hmm.
because they negotiate prices with hospitals and things. There's about $1,000 a year that is paid for by all the people in the United States who are insured that just goes into the pot that the insurance industry has to pick up for people who are uninsured because of the mandate that Ronald Reagan put into law in 1986 that hospitals have to treat people even if those people can't pay. You may have paid the hospital bill. You're the exception. Most people who show up at the ER because they have no health insurance don't pay the hospital bill. And the hospital picks up part of that, and the insurance companies pick up part of that. And so we do pay for it. Now, I don't mean to be putting you down. And in the fact that you don't have the money to buy health insurance, and yet you're presumably making more money than qualifies you for Medicaid, puts you in that sweet spot for Obamacare. That's you're probably in the income category where you'll be able to get free health insurance from Obamacare. No penalty, no tax, no nothing. And that will be a great thing for all of us. But my point is that if you're going to have a national health care system that requires people to buy health insurance, which is not my choice. My choice would be everybody's part of Medicare, right? Everybody, a single payer. But if you're going to have a system like Romney Obamacare, where everybody has to buy into it, and there are some people who choose not to buy into it, even if they're making over $60,000 a year, below which is the point at which it's basically free, even if they're making more than that, and they choose not to buy into it either because they think they're invincible or they're trying to make a political statement the way that Rick Scott down in Florida said, no, we won't take your $1 billion in transportation money to build high-speed rail between Tampa and Orlando because it would create jobs and it would make Obama look good, right? So there's some people who are going to say no to Obamacare just to make a political statement. They're free riders, to quote Mitt Romney. They're, and I'm not specifically accusing you of that. I'm saying those people, when this goes into place, those people who choose to pay $695 a year rather than taking free health insurance, they're the outliers. They're the free riders.
Right. But just for the record, I just love people to understand that there are people out there uninsured that do pay their bills.
Yeah, it's a giant crack in the middle that you've fallen into. And that's one of the main goals of Obamacare is to fill in that crack in the middle for people who can't afford to pay for health insurance. And you're right, it's absurdly priced. I mean, $1,000, $1,200 a year for a family of four who can't afford it and yet are not so poor that they qualify for Medicaid. And that's a horrible spot to be. And that's where so much of the American middle class is. I mean, the median income in the United States for a single person, the median income for a wage earner in the United States right now is $25,600 a year. The median family income in the United States is a little under $44,000 a year. I don't know how you can spend $14,000 a year on health insurance when your income is $40,000 a year and the first $6,000 or $8,000 of that is going to pay property taxes, state taxes, and sales taxes, even if you're not paying any federal income tax. I don't know, it's not possible. And that's why, Obamacare is better than nothing. So my apologies if I offended you, but I hope you get it that was not my intent.
I do. I understand it, and I appreciate your explanation.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks for the call. Kathy, I appreciate it, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Great call. George in Aberdeen, New Jersey. Is that right?
That is correct, Tom.
Hey, what's up?
I just want to thank you for everything you do. I have a question. Is there some unwritten rule that says a sitting president cannot criticize his predecessor or a previous president? And the reason I'm saying that is all Obama needs to do is come out and say, give me a Democratic Congress and I will get the progressive movement going and give us prosperity like during the Clinton administration.
Right.
But if you elect somebody like Mitt Romney, the only thing that's going to happen is that the rich are going to get richer and it may lead to economic collapse again.
Right. That message that you just shared was the message of the Harry Truman 1948 presidential campaign. And not only did Truman win, it was a squeaker, but he won. Not only did Truman win, but the Democrats took back the House of Representatives and held it for another 40-plus years. So it's a powerful message. And I, as Bernie Sanders said in the last hour, I don't understand why the Democrats don't pick it up and run with it.
I think Obama should get on that message and just keep hammering it home, showing them the contrast between what's going to happen if the Republicans win and if the Democrats win.
Yeah, he should say, you want to accuse me of class warfare? I'll show you class warfare. That's another one of those great quotes that could be taken out of context. Let Warren Buffett say it. Yes, there is class warfare in America, and my class is winning, which is what Warren Buffett said. George, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Anything Goes Friday, and drop by TomHartman.com. We've got a brand new or newly updated app for the iPhone and the iPad. It's really cool. Welcome back. It's Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. And I know that we got a lot of calls here, but I just wanted to just recap what's going on in the world. 12 dead, maybe as many as 70 wounded. The numbers are still all over the map here in Colorado. This is really, really a grim situation. Much of this done with an assault weapon that under the 1994 assault weapons ban would have been illegal. In screwed news, the six Walmart heirs now own more wealth than the bottom 40% of Americans combined. Mitt Romney has avoided paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes through creative accounting tricks. Geez, surprise, surprise. I have a bunch of details on this, but your eyes will glaze over. Sheriff Joe Arpaio he's on trial right now for being America's most racist sheriff. And across the Atlantic in Spain, the banksters are forcing the people to swallow an $80 billion austerity pill, and the people are not pleased. Expect Spain to go in the tank next. Austerity makes no sense. None whatsoever. Art in Goshen, New York. Hey, Art, what's up?
Hey, I just was reading recently again, finding that when Canadian health care was put into effect, the first bit was for the hospitals, and compared to 2,000 pages here in the United States, or plus 2,000, it was 6 pages. A few years later, this is from a book by Pat and Hugh Armstrong from 1998.
You're talking about the original Saskatchewan Public Health Act.
Well, no, this was the Federal Act. The Federal Act that...
Well, there is no Federal Act in Canada. In Canada, every single one of the provinces administers their own program.
Yeah. But it started out with 6 pages for the hospitals. Then a few years later, the doctors were brought in, and that legislation was 8 pages. And then the other thing that's been bothering me is nobody is mentioning that for years, when Roosevelt's Social Security was put into effect and then Johnson's Medicare, right, that the initial taxes were based on the income of a person. And I started working back in the 60s, and I would get a break that the taxes would be cut off, and I was earning, my first job was $6,300, and I'd get a few hundred dollars
a year.
Yeah. And the next thing that benefited us was that at a certain point around October, November, those taxes would stop, and I'd get a little bit more money in the paycheck, and I had 3 kids, so it was quite a benefit.
Yeah.
And then now the cutoff level is about $105,000, where people pay taxes for Social Security and Medicare.
Right. It's actually up to 110 now, but yes.
110. Okay. I wasn't aware of that. Yeah. And the fact of it is that, say it's 10%. I don't know what the exact figure is that we have taken out of our income for for the tax.
It's a little over 3% for you and a little over 3% for your employer.
Okay, so
3.6 to 3.8, something like that, almost 4%.
So then for somebody earning $1 million, they would stop at $110,000.
That's
and
right.
That would be about a tenth of what a person is paying out of a salary earning up to $110,000.
That's correct. And it would be, several orders of magnitude greater than somebody who only earns $10,000 or $12,000 a year.
Yes, and I think that's ridiculous. Nobody's talking about it even.
I agree it's ridiculous that only working people, that Mitt Romney does not, because he takes his income as dividends or as carried interest, he takes it in those ways where you pay a maximum 15% income tax. He also doesn't pay Social Security on that kind of income. And
wow.
and you get people who are making 10, 20, 30 million bucks a year like Mitt Romney, And even if they take it as income, which he doesn't, but even if they take it as ordinary income, which is subject to a 35% federal income tax rate, once it gets up into those high numbers, the Social Security tax that they're paying on it is only on the first $110,000. And then after that first $110,000 of income has been subject to that 3-point-something% tax, or nearly 8% total, then after that, there's no tax to be paid on it whatsoever. And if you want to solve all the problems of Social Security, all you have to do is say, you know, everybody pays the same tax, whether it's Bill Gates or whether it's, you know, the greeter at Walmart. Everybody pays the same 3-point-whatever-it-is percent, 3-4% Social Security tax. And suddenly, and, you know, not only is Medicare or not only Social Security solvent forever, but there's enough surplus that you can make Medicare solvent. So, yeah, I'm totally with you, Art, and thank you for the call. And this is something that has, you know, we brought up over and over and over again, for some reason, the Democrats are not pounding on this. They should be, frankly, but they're not. Dan in Detroit. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for listening to WDTW. What's up?
Question. Mitt Romney tax returns, as Democrats push so hard to get those tax returns, and Mitt Romney was, say, to release like the 2007-2008, and with his type of wealth, you know, the possibility of him losing, you know, $100 to possibly $300 million, do you think, I mean, what if he dropped that and said, hey, I'm like all of us, like the rest of you guys, I got killed during these times. What if something like that happens, and, you know.
In other words, could this be like the old Uncle Remus story where the rabbit says to the bear, please don't throw me in that briar patch, because he wants to get thrown in that briar patch. And Mitt Romney's got some stuff in his tax returns that's going to make it look like, you know, he's not as rich as you thought, or he lost a bunch of money in 2008, 2009 in the crash, and that will work to his benefit somehow, create a sympathy factor for him. And so he will, you know, reluctantly release his tax returns like a month before the election. I think it's not inconceivable, but I think it's extremely unlikely. The fact that he's got literally hundreds of companies that he is the sole owner of, many of them nonprofits, many of them in the Cayman Islands, incorporated in the Cayman Islands, you know, something close to 100 of them incorporated in the Cayman Islands and in other municipalities, other countries around the world. These things all tell me that there's stuff there that he doesn't want coming out, and I think that's really what's going on. Dan, thanks for the call, but I don't think he's that slick. I should add the caveat to that, you know, well, the guy's worth 300 and some odd million bucks. You don't get that by without being certain amount of slick. So, John in Albuquerque. Hey, John, thanks for listening to KABQ. What's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. There are two people you never name on your show that you really have to resurrect. And the first one is Henry George.
Okay, the economist.
Yeah, I mean, he was one of the most famous people at the end of the 19th century before the neocons, you know, buried him.
Yeah, well, Henry George was also the guy who popularized the phrase rent seeking. And I don't think that most Americans even know what it means. So problem with resurrecting Henry George is, you have to, there's a certain level of rudimentary macroeconomics that people have to understand before they can even begin to understand how Henry George was making his arguments that were, I don't want to say counter to capitalism, but that, you know, nibbled around the edges of it, shall we say, of traditional capitalist and certainly libertarian ideology.
But, you know, there's a wonderful story about the creation of the game Monopoly.
Yeah.
It was invented by nuns who loved Henry George. Did I lose you?
No, I'm listening.
They started out as a everybody wins kind of game,
mm-hmm.
before it was bought by the company. And
it was Parker Brothers, you know, I think, back at that time.
Parker Brothers, yeah. I mean, it was no fun.
Yeah.
Because everybody won.
Now, the story that I heard, and there is a wiki page on this, actually, that's got a fair amount of information, although that doesn't mean that it's all accurate. But the story that I had heard was that it was invented in the 20s as a way of demonstrating how, you know, the Morgans and the Rockefellers and the Carnegies of the world ended up owning everything. You know, how?
Well, it really started out more as a demonstration of Georgist philosophy.
Oh, interesting.
How and everybody then, could win.
Yeah.
And then, before it was bought.
And then I got twisted about. Around. Amazing. Well,
yep.
John, thanks for that. Thanks for that bit of trivia. It's great to hear from you. And oh, you said that there's a second name that we'd never mentioned.
Vance
what is that?
Packard.
Vance Packard, the hidden persuaders.
And you know, the man in the gray flannel suit. And right. How much is too much?
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, you never mention that. I mean,
well,
you've got to.
You know, part of the problem again with Vance Packard is Vance Packard is dead too. And I mean, he was a big deal in the '60s. And the 70s and arguably the early 80s, but it's been a long time since anybody paid much attention to him. You know, let me throw in Gerrymander. And Gerrymander's, you know, brilliant book, Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. He wrote another book on economics. I'm forgetting the title of it. Gerrymander wrote some absolutely brilliant stuff. He may still be around. But there are a lot of unacknowledged people who have contributed mightily to the dialogue and the discourse in this country.
We keep reminding us of these great people.
Yeah, we should, you know, here's the challenge that I have. You know, I want to share information that is accessible and understandable and interesting, and yet my personal tendency is to get so wonky that most people's eyes glaze over because I just love this stuff. And so I have to figure out where that line is. It's a struggle every day. But, John, you're pushing the line. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
For those of you who consider yourselves economics wonks, get thee to the writings of Henry George. We'll find it best.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producer, Shane Farnan, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screeners, Paul Edney and Rain Koch, to our writer, researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum at WID, to all the great folks at our syndicators, Dial Global, Pacifica Radio, Free Speech TV, Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, American Forces Radio, to the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to all the folks in our chat room, to Alan Ratner and Victoria Jones, all the great folks at Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and most importantly to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Letting our advertisers or sponsors, underwriters know that you appreciate their support of the program, letting our radio stations or TV stations know that you appreciate their carrying the program. Those are really, really important messages to share. Amy in St. Mary's, Georgia. Hey, Amy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I always like when you play that song that your father liked so much.
Yeah.
Two things real quick. I told your call screener I was talking about Gerrymander, which I am. Gerrymander is still alive, and he's featured in the documentary What a Way to Go.
Oh, great.
That is so good that free speech always shows it. But the other thing I wanted to say was, I don't know that you mentioned, because I was working today and I didn't hear your whole show, the role of antidepressants in these shootings. I know you're familiar with Dr. Breggin, Dr. Peter Breggin.
Peter Breggin's been on this show a couple of times. In fact,
yeah,
the first question that popped into my mind when this happened was, is this guy on Prozac or is this guy on Paxil or one of the SSRI drugs? Because,
that's right, exactly.
Because,
and I looked up a shooting in Finland that happened, and you know how it is. If you look at the websites from the international press,
mm-hmm.
they will say if there was an antidepressant link, whereas our press for years hasn't done it. You can't find a reference in our press. And sure enough, one of the Finland shootings was an SSRI, and I didn't look at the others.
Right.
But that popped into my mind with this man, especially since he dropped out of the PhD program. There's probably something going on in his life, and he probably was on an SSRI.
Yeah. I have not brought that up because I didn't want to go off on what some would think of as a conspiracy theory without any evidence, and I expected that probably in the over-the-weekend news cycle if he was, that it would come out. It probably won't come out in the mainstream media. They would never mention it. But there are websites that would report it. The tragic reality is that these drugs, these selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, this category of drugs, first of all, you measure them. Louis Melmadrona was on this program. Doctor, he's an MD and a PhD and a psychiatrist and a dear friend. He wrote Coyote Medicine, Coyote Healing. He's a Native American and very into Native American traditions and healing. And he was on this program telling us that, and he had the studies, that these SSRI drugs, when you compare them with sugar pills, when you compare them with a placebo, the placebos are more effective. They don't work, number one. And number two, what they do is they diminish affect enough. They diminish the ability to experience emotions enough that people stop experiencing the emotions of others. So they become essentially sociopaths. They become disconnected from the world in ways that cause them to do things, you know, like this. And I have yet to find, you know, some of them have not been disclosed, but it seems that most of the major high-profile shootings have been done by people on SSRI drugs. And they've got a black label, you know, a skull and crossbones. Well, it's not the skull and crossbones, a black box label on these SSRI drugs that says warning suicide risk. Because particularly adolescents and young adults who take them are at an exaggerated risk of suicide when they take these drugs. And one way to commit suicide is to take a whole bunch of people out with you. It's a variation on suicide by cop. And, right. You know, we don't know if that's the case here, and I want to make that very, very clear, mm-hmm.
Can I say something else quickly?
You may, certainly.
After Columbine, you know, they were quick to say that, I forget if it was Eric or the other young man, but, oh, he had stopped his SSRIs. Well, as you know, that just makes it worse when you stop him cold turkey and, you know, to
welcome
me, that
doesn't
get him off the hook. Yeah, right. Yeah. And Dr. Peter Bragan just quickly also posted on his website that because of his testimony in Canada late last year, a child was let off with a much lighter sentence because the judge came around and said, Dr. Bragan, you have convinced me that this young man did this because of Prozac.
Very interesting. Yeah, we should track him down again. I mean, there's the psychiatric establishment, and Peter Bragan is a psychiatrist. He's an MD with a specialty in psychiatry. And he's written several books about the toxic effects. I think Talking Back to Prozac was one of them. I may be wrong. He may not be the author of that. But he's written several books about this whole, you know, medical psychiatric drug industry and the consequences of it. And this is one of the more horrific consequences of it. So thank you for adding that to the pod. I was earlier, I appreciate the call, Amy. I was earlier going off on how I think it's the inequality stupid. And I do continue to believe that that's a big part of the problem, many of the problems that we have in our society. But if you're looking at mass murders, SSRI drugs, this is not going to win me any points with the pharmaceutical industry. But then I don't need any points. I mean, I've wrote those books on ADD saying it's not a disease. They've been upset with me for decades. So anyhow, we're just about, it's 10 seconds, too late to take another call here. My apologies to all the folks from Seattle to Texas to Michigan to Pennsylvania to Massachusetts to Florida to Washington State. Still on the line. We will get to you next week. But thanks for being with us. Thanks for calling. And coming up next on the Tom Hartman program, we'll have the latest information on the aftermath of the tragic shootings in Denver, plus the latest on Mitt Romney's tax returns. Is he going to cave into pressure from fellow Republicans? And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. It ain't a spectator sport. Participate. Get active. Occupy something. Tag your it. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.